Second World War, a podcast by Stephen Bedard.
Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And be sure to add our podcast in the How Did You Hear About the Podgo section of the application. I'm very thankful today to be having the opportunity to talk to Graham Hurley, the author of The Last Flight to Stalingrad. And Graham, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Please just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do in terms of your writing career.
I'm one of those guys who knew from a very early stage, and this was a very lucky thing in my life, exactly what I wanted to do with it. I wanted always to be a writer. And I think that came from the fact that I grew up in a house in a little seaside town in East Anglia, which is clearly on the east coast of Britain. Without a television. And I was a post-war baby, and that's important because without a television, what you do on long winter evenings is to read, then read, then read, then read. And my second stroke of luck, really, was colliding head-on with that avalanche of books, both fiction and non-fiction, that came out of the Second World War. My dad had been in the RAF. My mum had been under the bombs, the Blitz in London. And they had lots of friends and they had lots of stories. And in a separate career that started after university, I became a documentary maker, and I made a lot of films about wars, and wars are horrible. But the one thing that you can't argue about is that things happen to people in wars. And those things leapt out of the pages of the books that I was reading as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old, etc. And I think that sort of framed and nourished my imagination, and it turned me into the kind of writer I became. I've made films, made documentaries for 20 years. Towards the end of that period, I managed, finally, having written lots of mercifully unpublished, not very good novels, to get one away, a two-book contract. I was writing. And I did that for the next 7 years. I was writing big, fat international thrillers. Then I went, not my decision, but it was one of those sort of compulsory invitations you occasionally get from publishers. It's this or nothing. I went into crime fiction, and I wrote 16 actually quite successful crime fiction books. But all the time, I was missing that much wider canvas that the Second World War had provided. And my interest had been quickened by some of the documentaries I'd made. And then in 1992, I made a retrospective documentary, six separate films, addressing 10 years on the British experience in the Falklands War. And I was talking to men who, by and large, had come out of the forces, but whose memory of fighting that war, which was an extraordinary little war, echoed so much of the stuff that I'd read as a child. And then I just knew that somehow I had to tunnel my way out of the stalag that is crime fiction. And in publishing, as I'm sure you know, if you make any kind of success, then the publishers try and keep you in the same box. And I wanted to get out of that box. And I wrote a book called Finisterre, prompted by a story I picked up, my wife and I picked up on a long camping excursion in Galicia in northwest Spain, and it involved a U-boat that had come to grief on an offshore reef. And I worked that book up into a quite sizable uncommissioned manuscript called Finisterre, gave it to my agent, who was horrified. And he said, "But this isn't crime fiction." And I said, "Ollie, what you've got to do is to regard those 6 years, five, 6 years of the Second World War as the biggest crime scene in the world. So in a way, it is crime fiction, but on a much wider scale." And he found a publisher. The publisher really liked the work and commissioned me. And from that time on, I'm now researching book 8. Last Flight to Stalingrad has just been published in this country in January and has done well. I think it's coming to the States next month. There are two more readied, thanks to COVID, for publication. And I'm now at work on book 8. And it has been, dare I use the term, a complete liberation as a writer. That's a very long answer, isn't it?
Well, that's a good answer. I wanted to confess that The Last Flight to Stalingrad is the first book that I've read by you. And I've definitely enjoyed it and look forward to reading some of your other books. And I was wondering what inspired you to write this particular story?
Well, that's a very interesting question. One of the conditions that I and my publisher agreed on our first meeting when he'd read the manuscript of Finisterre, which is would turn out to be the lead title, was that for once I wasn't going to be shackled with a central character. Now, in terms of the 16 crime fiction books I'd read, they all revolved around basically two cops. And I wanted to break out from that. And he was very, very nervous about this concept. And I said, well, look, I'm going to come up with a fancy phrase. And that fancy phrase turned out to be something called soft linkage. And basically this means inventing a handful of characters. They could be German, many of them are. They can be American, they can be English. And they come and go in successive books, depending on the demands of the narrative and the circumstance and the plot, etc. So someone who figures hugely in book one may disappear for three books. Someone who carries the burden of the narrative in book two may crop up again in book three. By the time I got to book five, which is Stalingrad, I've had a long fascination with that particular battle. And by this time, because I'd made it my business to try and be fluent in terms of the chronology of the war, the broad bones of the war, who did what when, all that has to sink deep into my imagination. And it's only then that I can get on with the business of creating character. And one of the themes that came out from my study of what went on and the significance of that enormous battle. 6 months, 2 million casualties, turning point in the war as far as the Germans and the Allies were concerned, and the Russians indeed, was the power of propaganda. And this, at the time I was doing the research, which was 2 years ago, and this was... It was a period when Trump was in his pomp, when Johnson was about to become prime minister here, when contemporary politics were being put on their heads, as it were, by the big lies big and small. And I kept going back to what I knew about Goebbels, what I knew about the Ministry of Propaganda, what I knew about the shaping of the German public, and indeed the Russian public, and the degree to which a tyranny, an autocracy, men like Hitler and Goebbels can bend an entire nation, a nation that's, you know, produced Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and astonishing things. They can bend that to their will. And so I needed to come up with a central relationship, because in the end, I'm not a historian. I'm a novelist. I tell stories. And what I tried, I think with some success, to do over the previous four books was to mix real figures, figures with of tremendous historical significance, from Churchill to Field Marshal Allenbrook, Montgomery, Hitler, Goering, Himmler, etc. And then I began to concentrate on Goebbels. And I tried, I read loads about him. I read about his wife, Magda. I read about his passionate affair with Barova. I read about his six children. I read about is, you know, he's a Rhinelander. He grows up there. He's very ambitious. He's captivated by the Führer, and he's unlike some figures at the top of the Third Reich. He's genuinely clever. I mean, he's a man of immense, if black, talents. And so I needed someone to go alongside him who would be fictional. And in the end, I came up with this guy whose real name is Mikhail Magalashvili, and he's a Georgian. He's a little imp of a man. If he existed in the British Isles, he'd be Irish. He'd come from Dublin. He's very nimble, but he has the ruthlessness and the wit of Goebbels, and he catches Goebbels' eye, and they become close. I mean, the relationship is always bossed by Goebbels, no question about it. But to a degree, it's Naaman's job within the book to help himself. And of course, he overcooks it. And he's sent on a mission to deliver a particular letter to a particular lady, and he cocks it up. And from that, that sparks the rest of the novel, because Goebbels is looking for two things. He wants someone with Naaman's talents to put a smile on the pig, put lipstick on the pig that is this battle that's going disastrously wrong, the Battle of Stalingrad. And at the same time, he wants to punish the man who's let him down, who's betrayed him. And that essentially is the story of the book. And the moment that Naaman walked into the book, on page one, funnily enough, I knew it was going to work. And that's a very strange feeling, believe me.
I'm sure. Now, I was wondering, the character Werner Naaman, is he inspired at all by Werner Naumann, who was a German figure who did work closely with Goebbels?
No, he wasn't.
It's just a coincidence?
Yeah, a complete coincidence.
Okay. That's interesting. It's funny how that works out, because I saw this article on Werner Naumann. I'm like, oh, I already know the background to the story. And then, oh, wait a minute. No, this is a completely different person.
It is. No, it's completely different.
I found the story of the propaganda ministry to be absolutely fascinating. I'm sure that earlier in the war, the propaganda was a lot easier to produce when Germany was having all these great victories, and of course they weren't presenting straight truth by any means, but they had a more positive story to put forward. But as the war continues, and especially with their attack on the Soviet Union, things become difficult, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make a positive spin. I thought it was very interesting how they would send the cameraman in there just to take all kinds of raw footage, not to find out what was going on, but just to take raw footage. And then once they got back to Berlin, it would go to the editors, and they start with the message that they want, and then they find the scenes that will fit with it. It almost reminded me of like a ransom letter that you see in some of those movies, where they'll cut out phrases or words from a magazine and take all these things out of context and put it together to make the message that they want. It seems a lot like that.
That's a nice parallel. Yeah, very interesting. One of the things I found really fascinating about Goebbels was his admiration for the British talent to turn, to spin defeat into victory. And the great example, of course, is the Dunkirk evacuations, which by anyone's measure, to lose the equipment of an entire army. I mean, it could have been worse. You could have lost the army itself. But nonetheless, we got spanked. It was a terrible, terrible defeat. And yet somehow, to Goebbels' tremendous admiration, the Brits managed to turn it into a sort of national legend, a legend of redemption and rebirth and all that. And one of the parallels I found when I began to do serious research into that great arc of event that ended with the surrender of the Sixth Army and 90,000 German soldiers going into captivity and all the rest of it, was the speech that he gave the following month, or in fact the same month, February, in the Sportpalast in Berlin, when he used the catastrophe And he did really in Neumann. He used the catastrophe that was Stalingrad to rouse the 98% of the audience in that huge palace, who were men, into acclaiming the notion of totalitarian, total war. So turning, in other words, what turned out to be a turning point in the war, too many turns in that sentence, and using it to his own and the Reich's and the Führer's advantage. And I thought that was exhibited all the trademarks of that man's ruthlessness and cleverness and wit. And I happened to watch this thing about what little outtake from the speech, black and white archive, about an hour and a half ago. And what was interesting were the reaction shots in the audience. And it's a huge audience. And these men are leaping to their feet and punching the air and giving the Führer a salute and all the rest of it. They can't wait for more sacrifice, for more death, for more, you know, all the rest of it. And we now know, with hindsight, of course, where it led. But at that point, I thought, well, there was a certain sort of black logic behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was definitely very, very clever. One of the things that came across as I read the book is you definitely portray Goebbels as being very ruthless and intelligent. But there are times there that you also humanize him somewhat, that he doesn't come across as just straight monster. But he has some feelings, he has some emotions, he has this complicated relationship that he wants to continue, but Hitler won't allow him to. And
yep.
There were times that I was fighting the temptation to feel a little bit sympathetic towards him, because we are taught to see each one of these as being just a pure monster and with no redeeming qualities. Of course, his true colors do come out, but I did appreciate that you really made him into a three-dimensional character rather than the caricatures that we usually get.
So you think it worked on the page? Do you?
Oh, definitely. Yes, definitely. Yes.
And that's very interesting, and thank you for that. One of the things that's struck me with so many of these tribal figures at the head of the Reich, who else comes to mind? Goering, Himmler, above all Goebbels. And Goebbels is probably the best example. These men were lonely. They never trusted themselves to friendships because the infighting, the tribal wars at the very top of the Reich, often encouraged by, as you know, by Hitler and by Bormann, were lethal, murderous. And in the end, you know, they were all once children. They were all once, you know, the kid at the back of the class. It's very rare that you encounter genuine evil. And often evil is portrayed on the page in historical novels in a very two-dimensional way. And what I was trying to do, and I'm glad that you think it may have worked with Goebbels, is to give it a third and maybe even fourth dimension, and to point out that you know, in the end, these guys, his weakness, and I'm sure he had lots of weaknesses, but his weakness was an almost childlike reverence for Hitler. I mean, the man could do no wrong until, you know, the very last episodes in the war, when it was after the July plot and so forth, when Hitler was damaged goods, basically. And I was trying to, in various encounters within that novel, and I think the best one was when Neumann is taken out to Bogensee, and they go swimming together. And you get a feeling that this man, this all-powerful propaganda king, the Reich minister, desperately needs a mate. He needs someone to talk to. But even Neumann has let him down. And you can, what I was trying to get across was this feeling of disappointment, salted by revenge. And I'm glad it, you know, you think it may have worked.
Yeah, it came across that what Goebbels was so upset about was not just the fact of what happened with the letter, although that's what initiated it, but that the loss of that relationship he had with Naaman, even if Naaman was a lackey, he was one, the closest that he had to a friend. And Naaman's unforgivable sin was to break that trust.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that that's worked for me. Very glad.
Now, as we go ahead,
have you got time for a little story?
Definitely.
Okay, so you might ask me, where did Naaman come from? How did you conceive him in the first place? Well, two straight answers. The first one is he had to fulfill a narrative purpose. He has a role to play, but he's got to be flesh and blood in the end. And when my wife and I go abroad when we could, this is before lockdown and before COVID, but we used to do loads and loads of research trips, always on trains. And we our last major research trip took us to Baku, and it took about a month and a half, stitching our way across Western and then Middle Europe and then into Georgia. And we found ourselves on a platform in, what's it called, Batumi. And we got on a train. It was a very old carriage, and it was a 6-hour trip to Tbilisi, and we were sharing the carriage with two young, recently married Polish students, both of whom have fantastic English. And we settled in, and it was, you know, 10:30 in the morning, and they had a picnic, and they had some of the local hooch, and we made friends very quickly, and it was all great. And the train started to move, and then the door opened, and this figure stepped in, and he was carrying nothing but a plastic supermarket bag, and he had some clothes inside, and he settled down. There were three seats left, and you know, because we were all polite Western and so forth, we tried to involve him in what was developing into a very companionable party. And his English wasn't great. My Georgian is non-existent, but you know, we did our best to get by. And I said, well, you know, my name's Graham, and this is my wife, Lynn, and blah, blah. And how are you? Where have you just come from? And he put his two wrists together, which is kind of lingua franca, international lingua franca for I've just been in prison. And I said, my wife said, you've just been in prison. And he said, yes, yeah, done. And I said, so what did you do? He said, I killed someone. In fact, I killed two people. I said, well, how long have you been in prison for? And he said, 9 years. He said, I went in a fat man, and as you can see now, I'm no longer a fat man. He said, the food was dreadful. And we're all exchanging glances because we're about to spend the next 6 hours with this serial killer. And in the way of life, he turned out to be, as best as we could get through to him, the most engaging character. He was really good news. He was very sympathetic. He was very courteous. He did his best to explain himself and make himself welcome and make us welcome in his country. And I remember getting off the train with him at Tbilisi Central, and he said to me, he extended a hand, and I shook the hand, and he said, if you get any trouble at all in Tbilisi, ring this number. And he gave me his phone number. And that turned out to be Van and Naaman. And it was a gift from God. It was wonderful.
Wow. That is an incredible story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't even imagine being in a situation like that. It's funny how circumstances can come together to provide exactly what you need at that time.
Absolutely. And in the first place, you think this is going to be a nightmare. And in fact, it was anything but.
Mm.
In fact, it produced the best book I think I've ever written. Thanks to that man.
Yeah.
Thanks to those 6 hours. I've never seen him again. I'm going to dedicate the next book to him. I don't know his first name. But I'll invent one, and I owe him a debt, a significant debt.
Well,
maybe the gods of fiction I owe a debt to.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. That was fascinating. Just one last thing about the propaganda. I just wanted to mention that we have been talking a lot about the Nazi propaganda, but we just have to acknowledge that they were all doing that, the Allies as much as the Axis, and that continues on today. And I don't know if you wanted to comment at all about how you see propaganda working today, if it's more explicit, implicit, or if you just want to pass on that.
What I'd like to say in the first place is that I've got a character called Moncrief, Tam Moncrief, who works for MI5, who occurs and recurs in the ongoing series. And he provides a way into British propaganda. And there's a huge contrast between German propaganda and British propaganda. And in the opening stages of the war, and certainly in the latter years of the 30s, the Germans were operating from a position of strength and then growing strength. So after 1940, you know, they bestride Western Europe. They've got probably the best army that Europe has ever seen historically. And we were on our knees after Dunkirk, which I've mentioned already, obviously. We had nothing, absolutely nothing. The Americans had yet to come into the war. The non-aggression pact, the 1939 pact, was still in existence. The Germans had yet to invade the Soviet Union, and we had nothing. But we had to, because every engaged nation has to disguise the truth with a bodyguard of lies, in that wonderful phrase. And we did it too. And in this respect, it struck me that we had a long and dishonorable tradition of spinning lies. And it began in the 19th century, in the days of the empire, when we were powerful. And some of those talents had survived, and they're largely located in the upper middle classes, in the public school system, in that educational system that gave us our most of our wartime coalition cabinet, etc. And that's where the lies came from. So it's the top 8% really of the of society. But there was a definite contrast between in this respect, the Germans and the Brits. And then, of course, you get the Russians as well. And they're all lying to each other. The book, I think book 7 in the series is called Katastrof, and it's set in 1945. And it more or less begins in Yalta, the conference at Yalta, the peace conference, one of the ongoing conferences. And there you had the fascinating ongoing, day after day, vision of these three major leaders. So it's Stalin, it's Roosevelt, and it's Churchill, lying their pants off to each other. So nothing changes. Now, bring it all up to date. And what alarms me now, and this really relies on something that didn't exist between 1939 and 1945, which is social media, is the growth of a culture which in fact pays no attention at all to concepts of right and wrong, of truth and falsehood, and so we're now wading through the swamps of fake news, and it's as bad here as it has been under Trump in your neck of the woods, and it's the moment when you realise that the bulk of the population, and this is true here, and I suspect it's true in your country, don't actually care. As long as there's a roof over their heads, as long as there's something to amuse them on whatever screen they happen to be looking at, whether it could be a smartphone, it could be television, it could be a laptop, whatever it might be, it's bread and circuses. And the degree of power that it puts in the hands of people, we have the most corrupt government in living memory. But people do not care. And I find that just extraordinary. We've gone through. I'm banging a drum now, but if you begin to tear apart in detail the small print that has fueled our pathetic response before pre vaccines, pre jabs to the COVID outbreak, when we've ended up with more dead per head of population than more or less any country in the world, when you work out that we spent £30 billion spaffing it against the wall. I mean, and no one cares. And that's that takes me back to that black and white reaction shot from the Sportpalast in 1943 in February, with all those thousands of men, most of them in uniform, on their feet, baying for blood. It's truly alarming, believe me.
Well, I definitely think your novel is a book that challenges us to think about the situations that we're in right now. And I just couldn't help but think of contemporary experiences as I was reading the ways that they're putting together their propaganda and developing their story and imagining how that looks today. So I think that that is helpful beyond just those who are interested in what happened 75 years ago.
Oh, Stephen, you've delighted me twice now. Once with Goebbels and once with propaganda. If you think that somehow I've smuggled in a contemporary message, I mean, that's what I tried to do. But, you know, in the end, I'm not writing an essay. This has got to be a story, a tale that engages people and keeps them turning the pages. And I have to say that reaction to date has been really good. In Britain, really good, and people are saying, "Well, you've written 40 books, and I'm going to read the rest now." this is music to my ears, believe me.
Yes. Well, you know, as we come to the end of our time together, I did want to just talk about one more thing, and that is Stalingrad. I really appreciated how you brought to life what the situation was like there. My impression from people who are just vaguely aware that there was this great battle, and even hearing of a siege of Stalingrad, are perhaps imagining that you have all the Soviets on the inside, all the Germans surrounding them, and it's kind of like a medieval siege where they're trying to break through the walls and trying to get in. Whereas you help us to see it was a lot messier, that the Germans were right in the city, and it was fighting from building to building, and was just such a desperate situation beyond what we can really imagine when we think about kind of the tidied battles that we often see on in movies and television shows. And I really appreciate how you gave a sense of, you know, how far this church was from this place and so on, that it made you feel like you were actually in the city.
And that's very interesting, because one of the things that struck me once the fighting had bogged down was the intimacy of those months of slaughter. These are two giant armies, often almost within touching distance of each other. And brought to mind, and I'm going to take you very briefly back to yet another story. And it's 1992, and I'm doing the research for one of the films in a series called In Time of War, which was a retrospective about our dispatch of the task force to reclaim the Falklands. And I was talking in a cab late one night to a guy who had become a cab driver. And he'd been a paratrooper at the Battle of Goose Green. Now, paratroopers in our country are red berets. They're normally football hooligans. They're highly trained. They're off the scale when it comes to the application of extreme violence. And this guy had gone through the training, and he said, and we set sail, and we went down a 6-week transit down to the South Atlantic, middle of winter, and we found ourselves on the Falklands, the most miserable place I've ever been. And then suddenly, I was engaged in a real battle to take a little settlement called Goose Green. And once again, they were within 600 meters, the defenders, defending Goose Green. There's a big abattoir there where they killed the lamb, turned it into mutton. and the paratroopers, the English paratroopers. He said, and I belong to one of the most highly trained units in the British Army. And if there was anyone amongst them, the 80,000 soldiers in the British Army, who should be, for whom battle should have no surprises, it was us. And yet nothing prepares you for the reality of armed combat. It is, by a scale of thousands, beyond anything in your comprehension. And we won the battle. We killed many Argentinians. We lost men ourselves. We won the war. We recaptured the islands. And we found ourselves back on board, coming home. And then I remember getting off at Southampton, and we'd had time to decompress and all that. And we were met by our families and our wives and our loved ones and our dads and our mums, etc. And they all wanted an answer to the same question. And that question was, what was it like? What was it like down there? What was it like? And he said, I made a compact with myself. I promised myself not to lie. And I said, we need a drink. We went to a pub. And I started to explain exactly what the reality of combat is. And within four or five sentences, perched on my bar stool, I realized that no one was interested. Everyone was signed up to a kind of 8 o'clock prime time version of combat. Not the reality, not the way it really is. And he said, and the outcome of that was that the only other body of human beings in the world that understood what we'd been through were the Argentinians, the enemy. And I think a lot of that applied on a much, much grander scale to Stalingrad. And thus, you know, you've got two sets of enemies there. A, you've got the Russians who are desperate to kill you. And B, you've got winter. You know, you've got cold. You've got unspeakable living conditions. You've got rock-hard earth. You've got supplies running out, hunger, famine. You've got disease, typhus. I mean, it was inconceivable. And yet, somehow, what amongst the many things that kept these guys going were little sparks of humour. And I remember one little story, because they were all plagued by lice, and they spent, you know, much of their time in darkness trying to kill the little bastards. And so, A, you've got to find them, and then you've got to kill them, and they're very resilient. And I think it's Naaman in the book that comes up with the perfect the perfect solution to lice. And he says, read them anything by Goebbels. Why would you do that? Because they'll die laughing. That was good.
That was good.
So there you are.
Yeah, as you're listing all the different threats that were there for them, you could also include the SS. I found that very interesting. The conflict between the German army and the SS, and how they had different goals, different methods, and and I actually found that very helpful too, because again, from casual conversations with people, they see the Germans during World War II as this kind of monolithic entity, that they were all fully on board with everything that Hitler wanted. And if they weren't SS, then they were at least SS sympathizers, and they all kind of thought the same thing. And so your book really brings out the differences between those who have different ideologies, even on the German side. So I appreciated that about the book.
Well, that's a third chuckle from me. that's great to hear. If you do get round to reading any more in the series, I'd urge you to read a book called Estocada, which was the third book. And it's set in 1938, and it addresses the growing resistance amongst the traditional Prussian army figures, people like Beck. And these were light years away from the ethic that kept the SS going. And I found that fascinating, this huge division within Germany, within the German military, between the frontline soldiers, particularly, funnily enough, in Operation Barbarossa. So you've got the Wehrmacht on the front line, pushing ever eastwards. And then you've got the SS, people like Jürgen Kalb in my book, who are cleaning up behind. And by cleaning up, that's a big C and a big U. And these are the Einsatzgruppen. And the front line are ashamed of them. And that comes up again in the book that follows, the Stalingrad book, which is a book called Kiev, which deals with events that actually happened in Kiev in September 1941 with the arrival of the Germans and the arrival of Kalb, funnily enough. But once again, being able to address pluck fictional characters that I've given page time to in previous books and then put them to work again on the page in a different set of circumstances, in this case, as I've just said, that set of events that immediately followed the arrival of the German, of the Wehrmacht in Kiev, is wonderful. It's a real fictional opportunity to address and tease out some of the lessons of recent history. So, you know, great.
Well, now I know the next book I have to read, so I appreciate that. I think you've made a sale. Well, thank you so much, okay. Graham. I really appreciated talking to you about this. This is a book that I have really enjoyed, both for my interest in the Second World War, but also in all of the things that you have to say about human nature that is found in this book. So it was successful on multiple levels. So I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you taking this time today to talk to us. Where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you?
If they go to www.grahamhurley.co.uk, that's my website.
Okay. Well, I will make sure to put that link in the show notes so that people know where to find you. And I hope that people will pick up more of your books. Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.